Don't go away till I get a picture of that with my cell phone, all right? Yeah. And I'm overwhelmed to see so many people here. You know there are no refreshments, right? Okay. So I just want, anybody wants to leave now, that's, it's so wonderful to be back in Portland. I went to college here at Reed quite a few years ago. Any Reedies here? One, two, not too many, okay, a few. And I never before wore my sunglasses in Portland before today. This is very unusual. Now, this new book is a collection of essays. I did not know what to call it. In the late 80s, in 89, I think, I had published another collection of essays, which was about the Reagan years, and I had called that one The Worst Years of Our Lives. So I was really stuck when I came to a collection of essays that cover the Bush years. They're called The Even Worst Years of Our Lives. And it's hard, and I won't even try to summarize the last 8 years. I wouldn't do it. I try to, you know, the essays were written in mostly the last 6 years or 4 years, and they cover some silly things. They're among sort of serious things. And there have been a lot of silly things going on. Scapegoating, for example. Scapegoating is one way that we deal with our problems in America, and we've had all sorts of scapegoats recently. Gays, for example. There's a scapegoat for you, going back to the Reagan years, in fact. And I'm going to read you a little snippet from one essay that I wrote on that theme, and it was inspired by Senator Larry Craig. Remember? Poor man, you know, for the rest of his life, he's going to be a laugh line. It's terrible. But he inspired me to write an essay called Fear of Restrooms. So I'm reading just a little bit of it here. I don't suffer from fear of flying. It's fear of airports that cripples me. Anything could happen to you in an airport. You could be apprehended by the TSA, the DEA, and as we learned from the Larry Craig case, by the vice squad. It's if I'm at the point where I'm beginning to develop subsidiary phobias to Cinnabon, Sparrows, and most recently airport restrooms. Now, I don't know whether lesbians hook up in airport ladies' rooms. Judging from my lesbian friends, they don't hook it up at all. They fall in love. They move in together, and they start spending their weekends in Home Depot. But if they do, on occasion, cruise airport restrooms in the manner of a U.S. senator, what signaling techniques do they use? And could I have been inadvertently employing some of them? Because, face it, how many of us knew that the way to attract a fellow male stall dweller was by tapping your foot and swiping your fingers along the floor? Does that seem erotic to anybody here? I mean, it doesn't excite me, but just a few days ago, I was in an airport restroom, ladies' room, performing the well-known automatic faucet activating gesture, frantically waving my hands, palm down under the faucet, hoping to activate the sensor. I was just about to scream, "Why don't they let us turn on our own damn water?" when I realized that the hand waving could be a signal. And that the lady in the next sink could be an officer of the law. I hastily abandoned the effort to wash. Now, this is all very strange when you consider that we're at the orange level of airport insecurity and have been for years. And there is no evidence that I know of that the 9/11 terrorists, that any of them, were closeted Wahhabist gays. And yet here is this effort to detect gay people in airports. Larry Craig, for example, was apprehended by a man apparently consigned to spend his entire day on the cam, watching for errant fingers under the door. Possibly, this fellow has some intestinal issues that made this a necessary posting. But, you know, this is a strange way to spend our law enforcement dollars, and another objectionable one. I just have to say one thing on the subject of gay marriage, which I'm sure isn't necessary to say in Portland, but I do go to a lot of places where I think it is necessary to say it. And the subject of gay marriage has been brought up again with California deciding that people who are married somewhere else can come there and still be married. And what I want to say is, if you don't like the idea of gay marriage, if you find it somehow distasteful and unnatural, do me a favor and do not marry a gay person. All right? End of discussion. Now, another scapegoat, illegal immigrants. You know, there is so much of that going on. There is so little mention, especially by Lou Dobbs, for example, about what immigrants actually do in this country, including the undocumented ones. But the Latinos have a word for it, which is trabajo. They've been mowing the lawns, cleaning the offices, hammering nails, picking tomatoes, not to mention dishwashing, diaper changing, meat packing, and poultry plucking. And quoting from one of my essays on this subject, the punitive rage at illegal immigrants grows out of a larger blindness to the manual labor that makes our lives possible. The touching belief common to the American upper classes that offices clean themselves at night and salad greens spring straight from the soil onto your plate. Another favorite scapegoat in the last 2 years, poor young African Americans. This is Bill Cosby's favorite target. He doesn't like the way they talk, the way they dress, and the fact that they don't name their children Bill. He feels that they've, quote, let him down, and he's a billionaire. Well, I get so tired of all these scapegoats that I would like to propose a new scapegoat group, and I would like to launch it in this room tonight, if we'll all get behind it. Unfortunately, I'm a member of this group, and some of you are too, but anyway, I think it's worth it. Old white people. Think about it. They don't work. They don't like to work. They hang around. They lounge on park benches. They play canasta. And you know what allows them to do that? Government money. We can expect the Heritage Foundation to reveal any day now that some seniors are cashing in their Social Security checks for vodka and Viagra. Yes. And I remember how in the build-up to welfare reform in the 90s, you know, the pundits were saying, we've got to stop welfare, it causes poverty. About that. Well, in the same way, someone's going to announce pretty soon that Medicare causes baldness. There's a correlation, right? And the menace posed by the elderly is only getting worse, because more and more of them are sinking into debt. What are they spending their money on? Well, I have to tell you, in many cases, drugs. Yes. How long before our streets are ruled by geezer gangs mugging us to support their insulin and beta blocker habits? Now, of course, the purpose of scapegoating is always to distract us from what's really going on. And what's really been going on, certainly in the last year, but in the years leading up to this too, is that most people are getting a lot poorer. I spent years, when my book Nickel and Dime came out, trudging around this country talking about the working poor. And I know I spoke to audiences who thought that was a pretty exotic concept. Who were these people? You know, what do they look like? But in the last couple of years, more and more people have been living in their own personal recessions, even before I guess it's not even official yet. It's a crisis, but it's not a recession. In fact, I guess it's not really anything to worry about, because the president told us yesterday to take a deep breath. You know, more and more people have been seeing their wages decline. Wages have been flat or actually falling for ordinary people. Their health benefits shrink. Their home equity disappear. Their jobs disappear. And now, of course, gas and food prices going through the roof for those who are lucky enough to have a roof who have not yet been foreclosed on. And along, of course, with those perennial sources of inflation, health care costs and college tuition. I just want to say a little bit about higher education and those costs, because I have a section on that in my book. And anybody here been to college? No. Good. Anybody been to college recently? All right, then you know what's going on. I want to say, first of all, because I think there might be, you know, some kind of defenders of higher education in the room, I strongly believe that everybody should be able to study whatever they want at any point in their lives, free, like in, you know, similar, like in some other countries. And I don't care what you study, Mandarin, number theory, particle physics. Like, I'd like to see a lot more people studying those things and studying management and finance. But when young people are told they need to accrue tens of thousands of dollars of college debt for the mere possibility of getting a job that might pay more than $30,000 a year, that is a scam. And that's what's been happening. You might as well skip the debt and go straight to that job at Starbucks, if you can find a Starbucks that's still open in a few weeks. Now, I just read you a little bit from an essay here on college costs, when I realized they were more than tuition, but also a, you know, fees coming at you from all ends. So I did this in the form of a satirical letter to incoming students at college. And so let me read a little bit from this. Welcome to Fleece U, where our mission is to take feckless teenagers such as yourselves and turn them into full-fledged citizens of our economy, meaning, of course, debtors. Many life-changing things will happen to you in the next 4 years. You will make lasting friends. You will drink more than you ever thought possible. You will lose your virginity if you happen to have brought it with you. But never forget that your real purpose here is to shake off the pointless freedom of youth and to assume a mature burden of debt. To this end, we have just raised our tuition to keep up with George Washington University, which is now $50,000 a year. And by the way, colleges do raise their tuitions to keep up with other ones, because it would look bad to have a lower tuition. You will also find us charging a plethora of fees, not just the student activities fee and familiar fees like that. Whatever, I've never heard of a student activities fee, you know, I don't know. In addition, we will be experimenting this year with a snow removal fee, a lecture hall seat use fee, and the installation of pay toilets in the dorms. It would be short-sighted to resent these fees, since they provide valuable experience in bill reading and will come in handy when you confront your own personal monthly utility statements. At present, we do not even charge any additional tuition for this training in bill reading, though we are considering adding a special fee in the future. My advice, if you're a parent here of young children or teenage children, do what I did. Do everything you can to discourage your children from going to college. Really, this is what I did. You know, no baby Einstein for you, I said. Back to the television set. Now, it didn't work. They were sneaky, but I think that's the best way out of it. I have a lot to say about healthcare in this book. Maybe I'm too harsh. You know, maybe I don't see enough of the bright side of the American healthcare system, because I read just a couple of weeks ago that 41 million Americans are getting prescription drugs in their drinking water. Yeah, free. All, you know, that's antidepressants. It's you know, all sorts of things are just right there in the drinking water. Anyway, I got really upset when Bush vetoed for the second or third time, I don't remember, an expansion of the state children's health insurance program, SCHIP. So I wrote an angry essay, which I will read a little bit of. This year, Americans will spend about $10 billion on health care for their pets, up from $7 billion 5 years ago. New York's leading pet hospitals offer CT scans, MRIs, dialysis units, and even a rehab clinic featuring an underwater treadmill, perhaps for the amphibians in your household. I talked to a professor who consults to pet health facilities, and she justified these expenditures on pet health by pointing out that pets are, after all, quote, part of the family. Well, there's another category that might reasonably be considered part of the family. True, they are not the ideal companions for busy young professionals. It can take 2 or 3 years to housebreak them. Their standards of personal hygiene are lamentably low, especially compared to cats. And large numbers of them cannot learn to sit without the aid of Ritalin. I'm talking about children, of course. And, you know, thinking about this, I got a little concerned about my 3-year-old granddaughter's health insurance. So I went to the website of VPI Pet Insurance, one of the nation's largest animal companion health insurers, to see what kind of policy I could get for her. In the application form, I listed her as a 3-year-old mixed breed dog. A description which was made somewhat plausible by the fact that her first words, spoken at the remarkable age of 10 months, were rough, rough, and doggy outside. When I completed the form and clicked to get a quote, I was amazed to see that I could get her a premium policy for a mere $33 a month. But you may be wondering, could a veterinarian handle common children's ills? On the hopeful side, let me cite the case of Diamante Driver, a 12-year-old boy who died recently from an abscessed tooth because he had no insurance and his mother could not afford the $80 to have his tooth pulled. Could a veterinarian have handled this problem? Absolutely. So here's my proposal. If we can't have universal single-payer health insurance, here's our fallback demand. Please make veterinary care available to all Americans. You know, seriously. Do you know that an estimated 18,000 Americans die every year for lack of health insurance, which is 6 times as many people were killed in the terrorist attacks on 9/11? Now, for decades, poverty and, you know, economic misery has been seen by pundits and sometimes even sociologists as an isolated, quote, social problem. It is not. It is the flip side of an enormous bubble of wealth that has grown up at the other end of the social spectrum. And that is the connecting theme of this new book. We are a highly polarized society. I urge you to read the issue of The Nation that came out two weeks ago, about the new inequality in America. The only group that has seen serious income growth in recent years is in the top 1.5% of the income distribution. Sales of private jets are soaring, while low-wage people take multiple bus trips to get to work. The market for cosmetic surgery is booming, while 47 million Americans, of course, have no access to basic care. The rich can afford Congress people, while more and more Americans struggle to buy lunch. If there is a social problem here, all right. Thank you. If there's a social problem here, it isn't the poor, it is the super rich. We do the work, they get the wealth. Here's a statistic to chew on that comes from that issue of The Nation. The richest 1% of Americans now have more wealth collectively than the bottom 90% of Americans. While our infrastructure decays, while 60,000 jobs are lost every month and have been since the beginning of this year, while oil prices are driving up the costs of everything we consume, That top 1% is sitting on $20 trillion, and the oil companies are as happy as pigs in shit. Not to mention that we are spending $12 billion a month on the war in Iraq. Now, when you say this, somebody is bound to say, but aren't you talking class warfare? Isn't this class warfare? Damn straight. That's what it is. But I did not start this war. You did not start this war. The other side did when they decided we could live on less and less while paying more and more for everything. And it is time we fought back. To just quote from myself here. Well, how many wake-up calls do we need, people? How many broken levees, drowned cities, depleted food pantries, people dead from lack of ordinary health care? We approach the end of the 21st century in a bleak landscape cluttered with boarded up foreclosed homes and littered with broken dreams. The presidential candidates talk about change, but don't bother to articulate what kind of change. Why don't we dare say it? The looting of America has gone on too long, and the average American is too maxed out, overworked, and overspent to have anything left to take. We need a new deal, a new distribution of power and wealth, if we would like to restore the beautiful idea that was America. Thank you.
You've been listening to feminist author, columnist, and political activist Barbara Ehrenreich talking about her latest book, This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. Ms. Ehrenreich spoke at Powell's City of Books in Portland, Oregon, on July 16, 2008. Barbara Ehrenreich is a regular contributor to Harper's and The Nation magazines, and her columns have appeared in The New York Times and in Time magazine. Her books include Women in the Global Factory, Remaking Love, The Feminization of Sex, with Elizabeth Hess and Gloria Jacobs, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, Nickel and Dimed, On Not Getting By in America, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, and many others. To find out more about Barbara Ehrenreich and for a complete listing of her books and publications, please visit her website at barbaraehrenreich.com. Barbara Ehrenreich also maintains a weblog at ehrenreich.blogs.com. And now we return to the question and answer segment from the program.
Okay, we can have questions, comments, announcements, and at some point I'm going to get some help if I had any hard questions too, because I have Chuck Collins here, who I worked with at the Institute for Policy Studies project on extreme inequality. We have Margaret Butler here from Jobs with Justice, and she's going to say something about how you can connect up with them too. So, questions and comments? Yes, the lady in the pink t-shirt?
The first question from the audience is about whether American women have abandoned any commitment to the broader community in favor of a more selfish attitude. As this audience member put it, it seems that American women have dumped Mr. Right, who loves this country and loves the American people, in favor of Mr. Wrong, who promises to keep them as a mistress.
That American women in particular have just are just interested in individually getting wealthy?
The audience member responded, saying that American women seem unconvinced that there's a problem. They seem not to care.
Hey, how about women? How about women here? Anybody unconcerned? No. Huh? What? Oh. You need to find some new friends. I think. And there are a lot of people here. No, but I know what you mean, but I don't think it's confined to women. I think there's a widespread, a widespread idea that, well, I could be rich too, so it's great, and, well, you can win the lottery too. But statistically, the odds are very small. This is a situation where you can, we've got to start facing things collectively. Say that we're all in this together. And not rather than everybody saying, I'm out for myself. But thank you.
The next member of the audience pointed out that some universities, following the example of Princeton University, have begun offering free tuition to family members of their faculty and staff.
No, I think it's wonderful that some of the Ivy League, the most expensive colleges, I think have begun to be a little worried. I mean, do we want a country run by stupid rich kids? I mean, that's really the choice. And I think we've tried that, the brains are well distributed throughout the social classes, and they've begun to catch on. Yeah.
The next question for Barbara Ehrenreich asked for her opinion on why there seems to be so little outrage among the American people about what has been going on in the country.
Why isn't there any outrage? I have, first let me say why I chose some things to keep that repressed. One is fear. People, especially I learned while working on Nickel and Dimed, who are in low-wage jobs, are more frightened of rocking the boat, perhaps than people who earn a lot of money, because they know they can't go 2 weeks, 3 weeks without a paycheck if they lose their jobs. They have no cushion, no flexibility. So poverty itself is terrifying in that way. Another thing I think that affects people at all levels, and I'm actually writing a book about this now, is positive thinking. I'm writing a book now about positive thinking in American culture and how evil it is. When Phil Graham told us last week that we're whiners about the economy, he was only saying a very common thing. Anyone who complains in our culture about anything is a whiner. You don't have to be a whiner or a victim. Just shut up and smile and, be cheerful and go on. We got to put an end to that. We have to all whine together loudly. But I want to tell you that I give you one example of people fighting back, which I kind of pounced on because I was so excited to see that. And that is the truck drivers who have been protesting high diesel fuel costs. Now, this comes out of no organization, no union, totally grassroots, coming from owner-operators of trucks who cannot afford the diesel fuel prices, who are, in fact, seeing their trucks repossessed. They demonstrated in Washington in April, bringing a convoy of 150 trucks into the city. They will be doing so again at the Democratic and Republican conventions this summer. And I am so thrilled. I told them, the important thing is that the rest of us see somebody standing up on their hind legs. Too many of us has just rolled over for whatever reasons again and again. And I think we need more examples of defiance and collective action. Sir?
Mm-hmm. The next question asked Barbara Ehrenreich to talk about the death of the idea of socialism and the effect that has had on the potential for unity and solidarity within the population.
Well, there are two questions there. One is about the idea of socialism. And there are many ideas of socialism. The idea of Soviet-style socialism is dead, and good riddance. Chinese socialism turned into capitalism, authoritarian capitalism. We know that. Capitalism right now is looking a little shaky. I hesitate to say that because I used to, in the 60s, hear from the Marxist economists who'd say, it's going to last about three more months, you know. And it's held on, but right now I'm beginning to wonder, hey, wait a minute. It's happening a little fast. Don't close the banks yet. That sort of thing. The other question, though, has to do with the spirit of solidarity. And can we muster that in America again? Or have we gotten too isolated, too fixated on our own individual plight or ambition or whatever? And I just want to remind you that the way Americans have made change historically is by coming together, and we're good at it. I'd say we're as good at it as anybody in the world. Our labor movement, until the 70s, you know, very strong, fought violent battles to establish itself. The civil rights movement came from this country. It started in, you know, with some college students and poor southern farmers and preachers. Started from nothing and changed our whole society. The women's liberation movement started in kitchens and living rooms. Changed the world. Went out around the world. We can do it. We know how to do it. And we have to find that spirit again. Yeah.
The next question from the audience was about the issue of limited bathroom breaks in the workplace. This audience member asked if there have been any legal efforts to challenge restrictions on bathroom breaks on the basis of the likely health consequences, such as urinary tract infections.
The right to pee, yeah. I'm glad you brought this up, because this is one of my favorite subjects, bathroom breaks. And when I was working in those low-wage jobs for nickel and dimed, I discovered they're not a human right. In fact, in some places I worked, bathroom breaks were so infrequent that I started looking back with nostalgia on that drug test they give you at the beginning. You know, that could be your last chance. And I'll tell you. But it's an ugly picture. It really is. There's an academic book written about bathroom breaks by a couple of professors at the University of Iowa, and the title tells it all. It's called Void Where Prohibited. And they talk about situations for women workers who have to stand in one place for hours, like cashiers and assembly line workers, where those women have taken to wearing adult diapers to work. But of course, one of the consequences can be urinary tract infections leading to kidney infections. And you know, it's just, people have no rights at work. In fact, one of the sections in this book is called The Workplace Dictatorship. You surrender your rights, your civil liberties, when you go to work. Big brother. Yes, ma'am.
The next question for Barbara Ehrenreich was about the sense of entitlement that many young people feel today. This member of the audience asked how we can expect young folks to be concerned about issues of poverty and public health when they feel victimized if they don't have the latest mobile phone or other luxury items they see advertised on television.
Well, I mean, some of this comes from the media. You do not see poor people on TV unless they've committed a crime. You know, that's about it. In all the sitcoms and series, people have amazing apartments. You know, single people working as, I don't know what they are, legal assistants. What were they in Friends? I could never bring myself to watch it. Huge apartments. And then I will never see this, the movie Sex and the City. You know, it's just a big advertisement for high-priced clothes. So, I mean, we have to fight that by being shabby role models. You know? The shabbier, the better. Yes, sir.
The next question was about the current downturn in the economy, asking whether an economic crisis might be the most effective way of bringing the poor and the working class together with the middle class in this struggle. Is it possible that it will be a severe recession that brings some New Deal reforms to our society?
Well, I think that's a good point. I call that kind of outlook the worsism. If things get worse, you know, things will get better. But and you know, I just want to say that nothing happens automatically. That won't happen unless you and I and all of us are out there helping make it happen, knitting people together, showing them their common interest. You know, we have a part.
The audience member responded, arguing that the middle class in this country won't listen, that you can't talk to them until they've been humbled.
Can't talk to them until they're homeless? No. We certainly can't talk to them if they don't have their cell phones. No, I think we don't have to wait till people are destitute to appeal to their common interest. Yeah. We have time for a couple more questions, and then I do want to call on Margaret Butler. Yes, oh, Reed, you're wearing a Reed t-shirt.
The next question is about the role that academia plays in perpetuating the class systems in America. She gave the example of Reed College, the way their admissions policy functions to reinforce class divisions.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. I think they do need to acknowledge that the academy plays a role in the reproduction of the class system. You know, that if you get into a more elite school, you're slated for a more elite slot in life, and whether you get into that more elite school depends a lot on what your own, you know, financial class background were. There's no danger from Reed, though. I read my alumni report. I read the alumni news, and there will be so-and-so from the class of 64 who has been raising sheep in New Zealand for the last 30 years. You know, hardly anybody gets a job out of Reed. So that's a comfort. I haven't worked in, 30 years? You got a job application? What is it for? Starbucks?
Actually, yeah, this is a Starbucks.
What?
This is actually a Starbucks application. I can put up the name for it.
Okay. A working Reed alum. Pretty interesting concept. That reminds me that nobody has asked the question I've been asked at every stop so far in my book tour, and I'm relieved you didn't ask it, and that is, what about Obama? You know, is he going to solve all these problems? Is he backpedaling too far to the right? I mean, all of you and 75,000 other people probably went to his rally a couple of months ago. No? No? You didn't? No, you probably did, yeah. Yeah, well, I just have one thing to say about that. He'll be as good a president as we make him. You know, don't trust any politician, any of them. Only if we make them accountable will they be accountable. Only if we are building the mass social movements, you know, that light a fire under him, will we get any change out of him. You know, and I don't say that to be disparaging. I just say that because it's true of anybody. Now, I do want to. I want to ask Chuck Collins to say a couple words. This is Chuck from the Project on Extreme Inequality.
I was just going to say, people. Barbara mentioned this working group on extreme inequality and the special issue of the nation. If you're interested in getting a copy sent to you and being on our list, I'm going to just have a clipboard during the book signing and going around. And one of the things that we're doing is a contest called Name Our Epoch. We're working on a whole bunch of issues around progressive taxation. There's a group here in Portland working on keeping the inheritance tax, things like that. But you'll see on our website, extremeinequality.org, and in this issue of The Nation, we have a contest till the end of the month. And Barbara is one of the national judges. So what do we call this time that we're living in? Some people call it the second Gilded Age or the time of looting. So we're going to actually have this contest. And the three judges are Howard Zinn, Barbara Ehrenreich, and Walter Mosley. And so you can enter the contest at extremeinequality.org. What do we name this time? The prize is a private jet. Well, a model of a private jet. But also, books signed by those three terrific authors. So if you're interested in being connected and want a copy of The Nation sent to you, I'm going to have the clipboard around. So.
Thank you, Chuck. And now I want to ask Margaret Butler if she would say a little bit about how you can be practically and locally involved in some of these issues of economic justice. And Margaret is from Jobs with Justice here in Portland.
Thank you, Barbara. And thanks so much for shining such a spotlight on this issue. So if you want to take it to the streets, if you want to build collective action around economic injustice, one way to do it is by signing up with Portland Jobs with Justice. We're a 17-year-old coalition of 85 unions and community groups working on workers' rights issues, specifically the right to organize and bargain unions. So when workers in our community are actually fighting to improve their wages, get health care on their job, and have some respect and dignity, they get in touch with us and we turn people out to support them. And we have lots of fun in the streets. We also work on global justice, immigrant rights, and health care. And this is one way you can sign a pledge that says, I'll be there 5 times in a year. So you're committing 5 hours of your time in a year to support workers. And we build this network of relationships so that we can turn it around by collective action. Thanks.
Thank you, Margaret. And is there something people can sign with that? Okay. Oh, all right. Yeah, in almost every city I've been to on this trip, I've had people from Jobs with Justice, say something at the book signings. I was impressed by Jobs with Justice also in Los Angeles, which is involved with organizing immigrant car wash workers who are extremely exploited. So this is the group to plug into for immediate action on economic injustice. And I just want to thank you all for coming. And hey, we're going to turn this around, okay? Bye.
You've been listening to feminist author, columnist, and political activist Barbara Ehrenreich talking about her latest book, This Land is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. Ms. Ehrenreich spoke at Powell's City of Books in Portland, Oregon, on July 16, 2008. To find out more about Barbara Ehrenreich and for a complete listing of her books and publications, please visit her website at barbaraehrenreich.com. This program has been brought to you by PDX Justice Media Productions. To find out more about our work, please visit our website at www.pdxjustice.org. You'll find programs featuring speakers such as Jeremy Scahill, Chris Hedges, Susan Faludi, Phyllis Bennis, Rashid Khalidi, and many others. If you have any comments or suggestions for our programs, please write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for supporting listener-sponsored radio, public access cable television, net neutrality, independent bookstores, and all forms of grassroots, democratic, community media.